used in Buddhism to represent the awakened energy of unconditional love and boundless compassion is a figure that's often depicted as having 1,000 arms outstretched and 1,000 eyes. An eye is painted in the palm of each hand that's reaching out. 1,000 arms to see all of the suffering in the world, and 1,000 eyes to see all of the suffering in the world, and 1,000 arms reaching out to help. Boundless compassion grounded in unconditional love. Quite a number of years ago, I attended a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, and there were about 400 adults in that retreat, and about 30 children. The children were having their own retreat, kind of separate retreat from the adults. And each morning the children would come in and stand in front of the adults before we began our sort of sitting. We didn't sit very much, but a lot of listening and other kinds of things. And the children would present us with what in the public schools in the United States is called a show and tell. They would show and tell us what they were doing, what their practice was, what they had learned, or something that they had done the day before. So one morning they came in, and they stood in front of us in a big long line, all facing us, spread out in front. And they didn't say anything that morning. They just all held up their hands. They all opened their arms like that, with their palms facing us. And in each of the palms of each of the children's hand was painted an eye. And then one little boy went out of the line and went up on the platform where Thich Nhat Hanh was sitting and painted an eye in one of Thich Nhat Hanh's hands. That was their show and tell that morning. And it was very inspiring, very touching, a really strong Dharma lesson for us. One morning, many years ago, I think around 36 years ago, a week after my two eldest sons were born, they were twins, identical twins, I was holding one of them, and it was very early in the morning. The first dawn light was just breaking through. And moments before this, he had woken up from sleep, and he was quite contented, quite relaxed in my arms that morning. A kind of early morning sweetness and tenderness between us. And as I stood there holding him and looking into his face, my heart began to kind of tremble, kind of quiver. And the vibrations permeating, spreading out through my chest and all through my body and my mind in a certain way. And the experience was one of a very deep, great connection in that morning, early morning light, a really profound intimacy with this new being that I was holding in my arms. Intricately interwoven within those intimate moments of peace and a deep love was an intuitive moment, an intuitive knowing that came in quite surprisingly, actually. that at times this tiny being in my arms was going to experience great suffering as his life unfolded. That there would be difficult situations and numerous painful bodily and mental feelings within himself. The experience that morning, during the experience that morning, I felt no fear whatsoever about it. And there wasn't any feeling of a kind of entrapment, and no contraction away from this knowing. There wasn't any feeling of needing to control or do anything in the midst of this experience. It just was as it was. There was a feeling of a very spacious and very deep connection, what we could call a radical acceptance, a radical receptivity. Just really simply allowing the experience to be there and honoring it, really honoring it, and honoring this being that was in my arms, and honoring his life in those moments, however he and it would be over the years as it unfolded. There was a clear sense that morning that difficulty and the sometimes great suffering that accompanies it is within the natural unfolding of life. That this is the way of things, this is the way of beings. In those moments of holding my new son that day, there was a great clarity and depth of this knowing, and really up until that point in my life had never been touched. That clarity and knowing had never come so with so much profundity as this particular time. And I've never forgotten it, obviously. It's a long time ago, but still remember it quite well. And as I was standing there, tears filled my eyes. But they weren't the heart-aching tears that accompany feelings of a strong attachment or feelings of helplessness. These tears were the juice, we could say, of experiencing a very deep connection and a deep acceptance and an understanding that went way beyond just my son and I in those amazing moments that morning. They were the tears of the heart of compassion. A few moments of the purity of unconditional love in the heart of compassion. And those moments have revisited me a number of times over the years. And every time they revisit, it's as though the world is new again, and my heart, my mind opens, receptive, ready to receive it, however it is. Compassion, it's a very, very tender, open state, and at the same time, it's a place within us of great, great strength. We're able to be present with whatever's happening. Even with the capacity of heart, of mind, to see maybe the helplessness of those who might be quite overwhelmed with difficulties, with suffering. We're able to accept that it is. And we're able to offer help in whatever ways might be appropriate without any kind of aversion. True compassion is when we can open our heart to the anguish, to the suffering of any being, all beings, any being, ourself included, and not think that the pain of another is more important than our own, or that ours is more important than that of another. And so as we practice metta, which is very closely connected to karuna, which is compassion, we're cultivating an immeasurable impartiality, a pure and fearless openness without territorial limitation, a pure and fearless openness without territorial limitation. The energy of metta, karuna, it's like the moon, the full moon shining in the sky with its clear reflection in every drop of water on the earth. This heart mind of loving kindness that grows and deepens with our practice begins to really shine the light, we could say, of itself on all of the hues of our rainbow body, our rainbow mind, our rainbow heart, and this rainbow life. And I heard some of you got to see a rainbow up there today. And this is a quote that I did read in one talk during the Vipassana retreat, but it's worth hearing again. It comes from Desmond Tutu from South Africa. Africans believe in something that's difficult to render in English. We call it Ubuntu Boto. It means the essence of being human. You know when it's there and when it's absent. It speaks about humanness, gentleness, hospitality, putting yourself out on behalf of others, being vulnerable. It embraces compassion and toughness. It recognizes that my humanity is bound up in yours, for we can only be human together. I think it's important that we look at what compassion is and explore that. It's also important to look at what compassion isn't. It isn't feeling sorry for. Pity is what's called the near enemy of compassion. Feeling sorry for, pitying. It looks like compassion. It may be thought of as compassion. Pitying ourself or pitying another when there's difficulty and suffering, when this is what's being experienced, or feeling sad, grieving for not having something that's wished for, or feeling the ache of missing something that either yourself or another has no longer. None of these are really true compassion. Pity, feeling sorry for, And I don't know how that translates into Hebrew, but in English it has a very different meaning than compassion. Although a lot of people think it's compassion. Pity actually touches pain with fear instead of mercy, instead of a true open-hearted presence. Pity is actually a subtle form of aversion. It's actually a contraction away from, a kind of recoiling from. When we pity, there's a subtle, or maybe not so subtle, wanting it to be different, wanting the situation to be different. And there also may be some feeling that I'm glad it's not me that's suffering so much. So pity tinged with a kind of arrogance. That arrogance really being a cover-up for our fear or our inability at that particular moment to be with the suffering that we're encountering. And we all know that when we pity ourselves, when we feel sorry for ourselves, in those moments, actually we're not experiencing a caring. We're not experiencing a kindness or a compassion for ourselves. But that feeling sorry for oneself state is very sticky, kind of a very stuck place, kind of a sinking, feeling sorry, poor me feeling. You know that feeling when you feel sorry for yourself and you just get in the bed and pull the covers over your head and you're stuck there, you know. In this place, there's actually not much, if any, capacity towards taking care of ourselves easily, taking care of ourselves wisely, taking care of ourselves happily. And so we practice befriending ourselves over and over and over again, even in the midst of maybe resistance or difficult or painful bodily experiences, mental states. We practice befriending others over and over and over again. Our heart at times open, at times filled with resistance. And we also practice acknowledging and coming close to our experiences of body-mind, letting go of relating to experience through the veils of concept, through the ideas of pain, the thoughts of pain. We practice vipassana. We practice coming very close, so close as to touch our experience with awareness, mindful awareness. Awareness, the natural, spacious luminosity of the mind. The mindfulness, the active aspect of awareness, seeing clearly. We practice all of this. Seeing the pain in our back, our knee, or the fear or anger in our heart, seeing it clearly as it is, its specific textures, its flavors, its changing conditional nature, pulling out the thread of self with this clear seeing. This too is a direct line, a very natural direct line towards the development of compassion. It's also a process of befriending ourselves in the midst of suffering, rather than trying to push it away or hide from it or even to just kind of put up with it until it's over. And so we practice befriending ourself through metta practice, through vipassana practice, befriending others through the metta practice, and the natural evolution of connection with others through the vipassana practice. All of it helpful, useful. Our relationship to suffering isn't always as Desmond Tutu described it. It has lots of other flavors. Our relationship to befriending ourselves isn't always pure, or our relationship to befriending others isn't always clear and pure. And so we practice. Like to share again a little bit from Shantideva, the 8th century Buddhist monk. And I talked last night a little bit about his exploration and his experience around this vow to achieve awakening for the sake of all living beings, which I say at the beginning of the day and the end of the day each day since we've been practicing here. And his discovery in his own practice that this wish is an inevitable consequence of the sudden eruption of unconditional love. And so we follow the Buddha's advice to practice, understand, and we come to understand the contingency, the interconnection, the changing nature. And we practice cultivating this boundless capacity of our heart, encouraging it to open, bringing a clarity, bringing a strength, a confidence along the way of this encouragement. And in that process, we also open to the anguish of ourselves and others, as we've looked at, the suffering, which begins to prompt quite a spontaneous longing, we could say, to assuage suffering, our own and others, to help alleviate it. I mean, that's what the practice, the intention of the whole practice is. But this connection that begins to happen really directs our heart, our mind, towards the wish to alleviate the suffering of the world. It's quite a natural evolution of practice. Someone in one of the discussion groups the other day said that there's such a strong wish to share this practice just with friends and family who don't practice, to give it to them, to offer it to them, to help them. It comes up. It's quite natural. And certainly in relation to our close people. But it begins to expand out. Shantideva talks about his, what someone called his sufficient ironic self-awareness. This irrational, really, passion to save other people, to save the world. I mean, it's quite irrational, actually, to think that we're going to save the whole world, make everybody happy. even though we might be saying that in our practice. And Shanti Davis says, was it not crazy to have made that vow when unaware of even my own limitations? So we make the vow, and we also begin to really understand ourselves in the whole picture. And it keeps the process of our heart opening. One Tibetan teacher told me that that vow, this vow to awaken all beings, he said to approach it, although it's not taught this way usually, but it's a skillful means. It's a skillful means. It's a metaphrase, basically. And so we practice and we say it. In terms of Shanti Deva's life and how he chose to live his life and how he chose to practice, he chose to not actually directly engage in the world, but to retreat from it, actually. He went up into the mountains, into the Himalayas, and he lived in solitude in the natural world, in the mountains. He lived in the wide open spaces of the wild world, where there is no, for a very particular reason, because there's no sense of mine. There's no sense of ownership in that world, in the natural world. And so that's where he felt he could learn very directly. And it's said that he wandered freely in the mountains for years, and he'd stop and live in caves at times and meditate. He'd find empty shrines and places in the mountains and sit there and practice. At the foot of trees he would practice in what he felt for him was great inspiration, the inspiration of what has been called the sublime selflessness of the natural world. It enabled him to see, and we can have the same experience even if we don't live out there all the time. The natural world is a mirror for us. To see, begin to see the pettiness of our self-centered fantasies. We live so much in that pettiness. Shanti Deva speaks, he wrote poetry, and he speaks about at the center of this spaciousness that he discovered, this stillness, this spaciousness, what he discovered was one of the primary learnings, awakenings, insights, was that he really discovered that he's not alone, that we're not alone, that he was not alone, but very intimately interwoven into the seamless fabric, the seamless web of all sentient life. This, in a sense, the heart of compassion, this connection, the heart of metta, compassion grounded in this connection. This is a poem of his about this very thing. Just as these arms and legs are seen as limbs of a body, why are embodied creatures not seen as limbs of life? Very simple, direct poetry. Our hands, our heart, our hands quite naturally reach out to soothe the pains of our own body, our foot. We rub our knee when we get up from sitting, or rub our back. It's quite natural. We do it. Why doesn't one as spontaneously respond to the suffering of others? I mean, sometimes we do, but a lot of times we don't. In this very same way, this very spontaneous way. Essentially, the not doing of this in relationship to others is really due to a very deep almost visceral, felt, clinging to the idea of being separate, to the idea of being a separate self. And as long as we're immersed in this idea, and we're blindly living in the midst of this fixation, this spontaneous concern for others will primarily tend to fall within the range of those who we think of as mine, those that are my family, my friends, those that are mine. And there may actually often be a somewhat of an indifference, or maybe sometimes even a kind of satisfaction in relationship to the pain of those who fall outside of the range of mine. This idea that we are fixed on of being a separate self. As our heart opens, our understanding deepens. It matures. And there's an easing of this constrictive feeling, these constrictive thoughts of me, mine, self-centeredness. And there's a feeling of empathy, a feeling of connection that begins to blossom. Our sense of being a closed, separate self, a closed cell, we could say, dissolves. Meaning, dissolving meaning, that we don't vanish into some bottomless black hole. People sometimes think that no self means dissolving into some bottomless black hole, and it's terrifying. That's not what happens. What we do is we discover that, really discover deeply, cellularly, totally, even if it's just for a moment, that we are a cell or a being that forms part of, that is part of, and forms part of what someone called an interdependent multicellular organism, the whole of existence itself. We actually begin to not just intellectually know that, probably every person in this room has some sense of it intellectually, but we know it in ourselves. I, this sense of I, it only exists in relationship to you. There's I, me, and you. But this me, this being, any of you beings, it isn't that we're eliminated. We're not wiped out. We're not dropping into some dark, endless hole. It's transformed. Me is transformed rather than eliminated. And we really begin to understand that there is only relationship. There is only relationship. I, me, you, them, we, us have never and will never ever exist in isolation. That's not the way of things. Not how it works. As we come to know this deeply, we can't any longer act as though the need of I, the needs of me are more important than those of you. the needs of you are no less or more important than the needs of me. And this is really the birth of metta, the birth of compassion. And this is again from Shantideva. When I act for the sake of others, no amazement or conceit arises. Just like feeding myself, I hope for nothing in return. Quite a number of years ago, I lived in Asia for a while, and I spent some time up in an area where there were men, mostly monks, and a few women, a few nuns, doing practices, living and practicing in caves and in huts in the Himalayas. And these people, for certain periods of time, sometimes years, I had one teacher who lived in a cave for 25 years. They may never, hardly ever leave their caves. I mean, they may go outside, you know, fresh air, hang up their clothes, that their one robe or two robes or whatever, but they don't really leave their caves. People bring them food and water. And I remembered this. I was on retreat for a month this last January, alone, in Taos, in the mountains where I live, but in my own house. I spent a full month practicing by myself. I never saw another person or talked to another person. And I thought about these people in the Himalayas. I remembered them, and I felt very connected to them. I felt grateful. I felt a lot of gratitude that they were doing that, and I was doing something, excuse me, similar in my own way. And I also felt, when I was in Asia and spent some time up in that area, and then when I remembered it, I remembered it a number of times, that these people who practice this way in these caves that may be there for years, they have quite a strong effect in the world in certain ways. Someone once said that they think that the people that practice this way are part of the reason that the world hasn't destroyed itself so far. Part of the reason. I think definitely that's true. Part of the reason. They're part of the reason I practice. They're very inspiring. The strength of our heart, the strength of our mind, yours and mine, it can be purified, focused, and become a very potent force in the world. In the world, in our local environment, where we live. Our practice really is a strong power, a strong direction towards living in connection with, in whatever ways we're able to, and be effective. So with this heart of loving kindness, this heart of compassion, great strength, trust actually in our ability to bear witness, to face whatever whatever it is, without having to make it disappear, ignoring it, without repressing it, or pretending that something else is happening. Aversion to pain, aversion to suffering, our own and to another's, actually says, I can't stand this. I can't stand this feeling. I can't stand to be near it. For me, and I think for many people, one of the most amazing people of our time, contemporary embodiments and inspirations of unconditional love and compassion is Mother Teresa. And I read a prayer of hers the other day. There's a video, a film about her life. Maybe some of you have seen it. Her life and her work. And there's a very short scene in that film where in India, where she stops beside the bed of a man who has just been brought in off the street. And he's extremely ill, very, very, very ill, and very emaciated, thin, and very, very sick. And he's laying on the cot. And she gets down on her knees very close, right next to him. And she looks right into his eyes. And then just very simply takes her hand and puts it on his chest over his heart. And before she does this, he looks like he's not there. I mean, in mind, he's not present. But he looks right back at her when she does that. And the camera comes in very close. He looks right directly at her. And for those moments when they're looking at each other and her hand is on his heart, there's an appearance, the appearance of enormous suffering on his face that was there just moments before. It changes, immediately changes. And there's this light that comes into his face, his eyes, and love. It's very healing. What we're doing, even if it's just for a moment in someone's life, in our own life, or someone else's. And just a reminder, because I've spoken this in some ways already, it's important to remember in our practice to be honest with ourselves, honoring and respecting our capacity of heart, of mind, at any given point along the way, and not pretend anything to ourselves or act out of some idealized image that we have of a loving, compassionate person. And also not sitting in our practice with expectation, waiting for what we think of as the right or the very perfect experience of metta, the perfect experience of a loving heart. If we sit there waiting for it, it'll never happen. So it's really important to know and to honor and to respect all along the way of our practice, respect our limits from a very genuine place of heart. That's metta itself. That's metta. And I wanted to share something from that I offered during the Vipassana retreat in one of the evening talks. I may have also shared this 2 years ago, I don't remember, but in 1996 I taught in Poland, as I mentioned last night, and during that time, at the time of American Thanksgiving holiday in November, a Bernie Glassman Roshi, Tetsugen Roshi, who I understand has just been here recently, maybe he's still here, I don't know, he organized the very first of three, I think, that have happened so far, what he called the Bearing Witness Retreat, which was at Auschwitz. And there were 140 people there from all over the world at that particular time. came for that very reason. One of the things we did together during that time in the evening was read, somebody would read a small piece out of a book called An Interrupted Life. It's an autobiography of a woman named Etty Hillesum. And I know some of you are familiar with it outside of me speaking of it. And Etty was quite an amazing young woman. She was very young. And she was 27 years old. She was a Dutch Jewish woman. And she lived in a large house in Amsterdam for quite a few years. Her health wasn't very good. And then she was taken to first the Westerbork concentration camp and then Auschwitz, where she didn't live for very long. The years in Europe, the years of great suffering in Europe were, for Etty, a time of incredible personal growth, amazingly enough. And in the midst of this terrible scenario of terrible things that were happening in Europe, in a sense she wrote the counter scenario. And her diaries, these readings come from her diaries. The book was put together out of her diaries. They're really quite an amazing account of the possibility of a human being in the midst of enormous, immense, extreme difficulty. Before she died, in her clarity, she knew that she wouldn't return, live through and return from the camp. And so she asked her friends to save her diaries, to keep them, because she somehow knew that that they would be helpful to people and leave people with some understanding as they looked at her or read about her. To meditate. This is her talking about it. I think I'll do it anyway. I'll turn inward for half an hour each morning before work and listen to my inner voice. Lose myself. You could call it meditation. I'm still a bit wary of that word. But anyway, why not? A quiet half hour within yourself. But it's not so simple, that sort of quiet hour. It has to be learnt. A lot of unimportant inner litter and bits and pieces have to be swept out first. Even a small head can be piled high inside with irrelevant distractions. So let this be the aim of meditation: to turn one's innermost being into a vast empty plain, with none of the treacherous undergrowth to impede the view, so that something of God can enter you, and something of love, too. Not the kind of love deluxe that you revel in deliciously for half an hour, taking pride in how sublime you feel, but the love you can apply to small everyday things. And then at another point in the diary, she wrote, "Mysticism must rest on crystal clear honesty and can only come after things have been stripped down to their naked reality." And this is from her last entry. "Ever since last night, I have been lying here trying to assimilate just a little of the terrible suffering that has to be endured all over the world. To accommodate just a little of the great sorrow the coming of winter has in store. It could not be done. Today will be a hard day. I shall lie quietly and try to anticipate something of all the days that are to come. And then the very last line of her diary. When I suffer for the vulnerable, is it not for my own vulnerability that I really suffer? And she ends with, we should be willing to act as a balm, a healing agent for all wounds. It's, and I understand that those that knew her and survived said that she was really quite a balm, quite a healing agent, and quite a luminous being, right to the very last. Very amazing person, inspiration. And this is from another teacher, from quite a different venue, from the United States. And some of you probably know this, we have a holiday called Father's Day in the United States. The Father's Day service this year at St. Edward's Catholic Church in West Baltimore was no greeting card homage to dear Dad. St. Edward's, like many African American congregations, calls the holiday Men's Day and uses it as an occasion to focus on the imperilment embedded in the daily lives of young black men in the black community, and to rally its men to the challenge. The men made their entrance in an exhilarating ceremony called the Procession of Warriors. And then the minister, Kiwisi Mifumi, spoke. You're not a man because you killed somebody, he said, to a chorus of amens. You're a man when you know how to heal somebody. We must say, even from experience, brother, you're not a man if you can make a baby. You're a man when you learn how to raise a baby. That's when you become a man. We might be surprised at any moment, by the arising of metta, the arising of compassion, in what might seem like the most unlikely circumstance, the most unexpected moment. And maybe not from the idea that we have about even not only when it might happen, but what it is. All of the, just another look at it, from another perspective, all of the relationships in our life, our family relationships, friends, work relationships, community life, and even in a silent retreat like this, all very wonderful mirrors for the development and the practice of metta, of compassion. Relationships with all of the likes and the dislikes, all of the joys, all of the irritations, all of the annoyances, all of the delights, frustrations, satisfactions, all that we experience in relationship to sharing life with others. It's the perfect ground for our practice, the perfect ground for waking up into our true nature, our Buddha nature, the perfect ground for waking up into the heart of metta, compassion. This precious human existence, with all of the blessings, all of the conditions that came into place to make it possible, for instance, for us to come here to practice. This human realm, the perfect ground for the development of wisdom, compassion, loving kindness, because of its particular mix of pleasure and pain. In what's called the lower realms in Buddhist terminology, the intensity of suffering is too great for most beings to develop the wholesome qualities of mind that draw us into practice. And in what are called the higher realms, it's said that everything's so blissful, sort of constant ongoing pleasure, that there's very little inspiration to practice. And that most of the beings that live in the realms of constant ongoing pleasure forget that it'll come to an end. I mean, we've all had moments of that. We've been in those realms, both the lower realms and the higher realms. So here in our human realm, it's really the best conditions for the practice of our liberation. There's a wonderful story that talks about this quite appropriately. The philosopher teacher Gurdjieff lived in France for many years, had a spiritual community there, people who came to study and to practice with him. And in that community in France, there was an old man who was a very difficult fellow. He was very messy, he was argumentative, he was uncooperative, he wouldn't help, he didn't like people, you know, he was crabby, and as we say in English, he was an old fart, you know. And he was just one of those kind of guys, you know. And he didn't like people, and people didn't really like him very much. And he tried for a long time to stay there, to stay in the community, but it was very difficult for him, as it was for others. So he finally left. He just couldn't stand it, and he left. And he went to Paris, and Gurdjieff followed him to Paris to try to convince him to come back to the community. But the man said he couldn't. It was too hard. He just couldn't come back. Didn't want to be there. Well, finally, Gurdjieff offered him a monthly stipend. He offered him some money to come back. And the man was very poor, and it was hard for him to refuse this. So he accepted it, and he came back, because he was paid to come back, basically. And when the man returned, everyone in the community was just kind of shocked, you know, and not really happy about the fact that he came back. And they complained a lot to Gurdjieff. So Gurdjieff called a meeting one night, and he listened to all of the complaints, and then he laughed, and he said, "This man is yeast for the bread, for your bread. Without him, you would never learn about anger. You'd never learn about irritability. You'd never learn about patience. You'd never learn about unconditional love. You'd never learn about compassion. That's why you pay me," said Gurdjieff, "and I pay him." So this human condition, it's the perfect place for our spiritual practice. Another little tiny story in a much lighter vein, in a way, around beings living together. Ryokan, a Japanese monk, it's said that he spent his time just wandering in the mountains and playing with children, and that was his practice, essentially. A very, very free, free-flowing being, you know. And it's said that at times, on a nice warm days, he would take the fleas out of his robe that lived in his robe. He would take them out on a nice sunny day, and he'd put them on a rock so they could air out and dry out. And then, at the end of the day, when it started to get cool and dark again, he put them back in his robe where they lived. So, compassion. And living together. Over time, our practice develops a very expansive, very deep tenderness, which really, truly does transform the way we live with ourselves and live with others, the way we relate to ourselves and relate to others. We see, we encounter suffering in ourselves, in others, and we recognize it. We come to understand it. And our capacity to be with life, with the joys and the difficulties, grows. It matures. Our capacity matures. Our ability to act appropriately and spontaneously in relation to life, in relation to suffering, to the joys and the difficulties, begins to be our experience more and more often. Our freedom, our liberation from suffering, what the Buddha taught, it's two-winged, two-winged. One wing being that of wisdom, the cooling balance, the equanimity of heart, of mind, that comes with the understanding, the insight of the empty nature, the not-self nature of all things. And the other wing being that of compassion that's grounded in metta, the heart's connection to beings, that comes through a very deep and clear knowing of the existence of suffering, the real cause of suffering, and the way of its end. Without both of these wings, free flight is impossible. I'd like to share part of a piece that one of my students wrote. He's a man that died of AIDS-related complications in January of 1998. He was a writer, and he was also a very deep practitioner. He's the one that I spoke of earlier, who was very ill and who practiced and died in this very clear heart of love. And this is a piece, part of a piece. My first 8-day Vipassana retreat. Trepidation and desire flood my soul in equal measure, will I encounter deeply buried demons from my past? Will emotions overwhelm me? Will I be able to stop crying? In the days leading up to the retreat, it's as if my body's attempting to erode the quiet resolve of my mind to go. Pain gathers in my back, making my daily sit uncomfortable. Unaccountably, my gums start to throb and bleed. My left leg grows numb. On the day I make the 2-hour drive to the retreat center, a splitting headache rips through my brain, bringing me to tears. I don't care what you do, I say out loud to my body. I'm going to that retreat. The retreat schedule looks daunting. From 5:45 in the morning to 10 o'clock at night, 9 sits alternate with 8 walks for 6 days. You guys have it easy. 2 half days are also full. Meals are deliciously vegetarian. The air is abuzz with insects feasting on the nectar of the hundreds of flowers around the center. Before we take up our vows of silence, I tell one of the two teachers that I may need to nap during the day, and am reassured by the gentle understanding I receive. Participate when you can, rest when you need to. By our first sit, all my bodily pain is gone. Blessed silence and avoiding eye contact with others enables me to develop a cocoon of self. By the second full day, I marvel that I'm attending all the sessions without the need for naps. I begin to feel energized and even find time to incorporate the Hatha Yoga series I learned years ago into the schedule. I sense new levels of awareness about the nature of this practice and about the Buddha's compassion. During one Dharma talk, we were asked to consider what a nightmare life would be if there were no change. By the fourth day, questions during Dharma talks increase in intensity. Is metta better than vipassana? Is vipassana better than metta? In practice, is holding onto the breath different from holding a thought? If we can observe our thoughts rising and falling, where do they come from? Where do they go? We're creating an energy of trust. My heart opens to all retreatants struggling their own struggles. Who am I to judge anyone? They are me. The rhythm of the retreat mimics the rhythm of our breath and the rhythm of nature. All around us, cycles come and go, repeat and fall away. On the last full day of the retreat during a walking meditation, I was overwhelmed with sadness for all humanity and for the planet. I cried and cried in pain. How can there ever be an end to suffering? And then I stopped and looked up at the hill behind the meditation center. My heart is though leaping open for a moment into the beauty of this life, into the beauty and into the suffering of all of it. My heart as though leaping open for a moment into the beauty of this life, the suffering and the beauty, all of it being held, but not held onto in that present moment. And close the talk with a poem by Thich Nhat Hanh. Please call me by my true names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird whose wings are still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I'm the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I'm the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I'm the frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond. And I'm also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I'm the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks. And I'm the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I'm a 12-year-old girl refugee on a small boat who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I'm the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes the flowers bloom. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills up the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and my laughs at once, so I can see that my joy and pain are but one. Please call me by my true names, so that I can wake up, and so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion. And let's sit for a moment.